You may proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, my name is Michael Robinson. I appear on behalf of the appellate, Patrick LLC. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of time, if I may, for rebuttal. The statutory provisions regarding confessed judgments contemplate an expedited proceeding for a judgment that is confessed in the amount which a creditor is willing to accept. The statutes do not contemplate, and certainly do not authorize, summary proceedings to resolve disputed claims. There is simply a bright dichotomy between judgments that are going to be the result of a confession and judgments that are going to result from judicial adjudication. The circuit court's failure to recognize that distinction or to apply that distinction here runs through all three of the assignments of error. First, the circuit court failed to follow the statutory procedures once it decided that the confessed judgment would be set aside. Rather than simply decide that motion and then proceed as the statute dictates, the circuit court resolved everything in a summary fashion and ended up entering a final judgment based essentially on a defendant's proffer of what the defendant thought the judgment should be. Second, that judgment was contrary both to the terms of the note, contrary to Virginia law, but what I want to focus on is it failed to respect a prior adjudication on the very matter presented to the circuit court.
Am I right that if your reasoning under assignment of error 2 with respect to the res judicata effect of the bankruptcy order is correct, then it does moot assignment of error 1 and assignment of error 3. Is that logically true?
It would moot it in the sense that the record before the court would allow this court to enter final judgment because there had been no adequate defense presented.
So the compounding interest decision that was baked into the bankruptcy court's determination would be the bar, the res judicata bar to further litigation, and that principle would be applied necessarily post-bankruptcy.
That's correct, Your Honor. That decision, would interest continue to compound after maturity, was decided in the bankruptcy court. It was a necessary decision in the bankruptcy court. And it would follow through.
The hardest question, at least from my perspective, under the easiest argument you make, up until the date of the bankruptcy order, that's res judicata. Arguably, beyond the date of the bankruptcy order going forward, if there was no clear evidence of a finding with respect to going forward for compounding versus simple interest, then wouldn't we need to remand it to the trial court under the res judicata theory, if it were correct, for fact-finding as to what was actually done in the bankruptcy court?
I think if the court was confused as to what was actually done in the bankruptcy court, then the matter should still be remanded so that that confusion could be resolved for the first time in the circuit court. I would submit to you, Justice Kelsey, that there really is no confusion. And let me tell you why. We start with what Hunter Mill told this court in its brief.
But, counsel, even if there's not confusion, anything that happens after the bankruptcy court acted would still need to be placed on the trial docket. There may be defenses, post hoc defenses of some nature. There may be a set off or a partial payment or any number of other things that the trial court would be able to tease out that an appellate court could not.
If, in fact, other defenses had been asserted as the adequate defense for purposes of setting it aside, I would agree with you. However, that is not the case. The only grounds, at least asserted, was that the interest would not continue to compound after maturity. As the matter proceeded, a couple of other issues snuck in there. But the ground for the motion was interest no longer compounds. So I would agree with you under a different set of facts, but it would not be applicable here.
But would that perspective really hurt you? If the court were to agree with your assignment of error 2 and say, No, necessarily the compound versus simple issue was resolved. It had to have been resolved, or the number would not have been what the number was in the bankruptcy court. So that's done. But as Justice Mims points out, anything after the date that can arise or could arise is still available to be asserted, because res judicata does not obviously apply to things not decided or could not have been raised at the time of the bankruptcy proceeding. But your suggestion is, well, there aren't any. Well, maybe, maybe not, but where's the harm in sending it back to find out?
Well, that would undermine the entire statutory procedure of how you proceed, is to decide the first issue. Is an adequate defense raised?
Well, actually, I was going to make the argument that your position would undermine the statute, because you're saying, well, this court can summarily enter final judgment, and yet your argument in your first assignment of error is the trial court not only erred by making the incorrect substantive ruling, but also erred by entering judgment summarily without placing it on the trial docket. Seems to me that having asked that it be placed upon the trial docket, that the highest level of relief you can get from the appellate court is for it to be placed on the trial docket, along with a ruling on the res judicata effect of the bankruptcy court's decision.
I guess where I would disagree with you, Justice Mims, on that, and I certainly hope I'm not undermining the statute, but the requirement that there be an adequate defense presented is a prerequisite to it then being placed on the trial docket, giving the creditor plaintiff the opportunity to prove the full liability, and of course giving the debtor the opportunity to defend. But that prerequisite has to be met. If this court concludes that the issue is precluded by res judicata, then the prerequisite is not met. And so I think I'm being consistent in saying that the circuit court erred in not following the statutory proceedings, but it also erred in not applying res judicata.
So your point is, under 432, the, quote, adequate defense or set off in an action at law, end quote, the only adequate defense or set off theory was compound versus simple interest. Is that your point?
That's correct.
And there was nothing else asserted?
There was nothing else, and in fact, as the proceedings progressed there, the court was told at one point by Hunter Mill, you shouldn't even decide the merits of the case, just decide whether this is an adequate defense. And if it is an adequate defense, then set the matter down for trial. I mean, that position evolved as their position got stronger in light of a ruling. But without that adequate defense, you don't proceed. And then, if there's a ruling that there is an adequate defense, it then gets set down. And the creditor, as I said, has the opportunity to fully establish its case.
But have you skipped a step here? They come in and they say, our adequate defense is it should be post-maturity simple interest. That's our defense. Read the document. The debt instruments say that. And you say, no, the debt instruments don't say that. And then you say, quite persuasively, I might suggest, in any event, that's been resolved in the bankruptcy case. Well, that's step two. That now we have to put it on the trial docket and find out if his adequate defense can be defeated by your response to it as well as your res judicata argument, right?
Well, the response, at least, I agree with you on the first part. If you decide that's an adequate defense, then it gets set down, and I would be able to argue what, you know, does interest compound.
Wait, isn't that what Justice Mills was asking you about? We would have to remand it to set it back on the trial docket to let him raise his adequate defense, let you raise the res judicata. We say, if we were to agree with you, yeah, the res judicata would apply, and that's a legitimate as of the date of the bankruptcy order.
Well, I think the res judicata issue, though, actually trumps the need for it to be put back on the trial docket. And if this court concludes that res judicata applies.
But there are continuing damages after the bankruptcy court's ruling. Typically, res judicata would resolve everything because the matter has been completely factually developed before the ruling that is res judicata. In this instance, there continues to be something thereafter that some court is going to have to look at.
Well, but the continuing thereafter, the only complaint about the continuing thereafter is you continue to compound interest. And if that is the only continuing thereafter, that is in fact resolved by the res judicata issue.
So is your argument that because your position is they did not raise an adequate defense, bankruptcy court decided the principal amount, and if I hear you correctly, you're saying we would then enter judgment for the amount in the confessed
For the amount of the confessed judgment, because here was what was undisputed. And when you go to the bankruptcy court, you know, they told this court, we filed that in order to get a decision on what was owed. Justice Kelsey, I think you pointed out, in order to decide that or to determine that, logically you would have to consider whether interest continued to compound. But there's more than just that logical necessity. They actually submitted to the bankruptcy court their calculation. That's in the joint appendix of page 289. That calculation shows unequivocally interest compounding. Each month, the interest is added to the principal balance, and there's a new principal balance.
Compounding post-maturity. Compounding post-maturity.
Compounding post-maturity.
So you have equitable estoppel as well as res judicata.
Well, you would. They had an expert testify to that, and then they had their counsel tells the bankruptcy court, and I'm quoting here, the debtor's spreadsheets accurately represent the loan, what the loan documents say. That's at Joint Appendix 270. So they have put before the court at that point, as well, and then we put that in front of the circuit court, precisely what happened in the bankruptcy court. The fact that interest continued to be compounded post-maturity. And then, it's also undisputed, and I think this is page 25 of the joint appendix, the confessed judgment simply took the balance straight from the bankruptcy court and continued to run the calculation, same interest rate, straightforward.
Is this a fair summary of your position? I don't want to mischaracterize that. A defense is not adequate if, as a matter of law, it's barred by res judicata. Consequently, there's no need for factual development. It's just a matter of applying the res judicata bar, and then you're done. Is that?
That's a fair summary.
Okay.
Before you sit down, I want you to save some of your time, but what do we do with this non-suit issue?
I'm sorry.
The non-suit question, I mean, if we find that has merit, then we wouldn't get to any of those things, but I'm not sure that's what you want.
There is a reason that's assignment number three. If the court decides in my favor on assignment two, assignment three is moot.
Well, how is that? I mean, if you ask for a non-suit, it would be granted, and the proceeding would stop when you ask for the non-suit.
I agree with you, except I would have used the words should have instead of did. Proceedings should
But if it was erroneous in not doing it, isn't there relief to give you your non-suit as of that date?
That is relief that could be given. That request for the non-suit, of course, was requested in order to try to obviate some of the other problems that were developing in the case or present in the case.
Are you making assignment of error number three in the alternative in the event you're unsuccessful with one and two?
I can go with that.
All right, well, save your time, all right?
Thank you, Justice.
Ladies and gentlemen, may it please the court, Chad Peterson on behalf of the Appalachian Hunter Mill West. And I think the rub of this issue is my colleague has no problem with the summary proceeding as long as they win. If they don't win, then they have a problem. And I think, of course, they want to short-circuit the litigation. That's what they attempted to do right off the bat. It's just they didn't like the results, so they wanted to go over and do it again. I want to walk through actually what happened at the trial court, because I think, at least from hearing the writ panel, I think there was some type of misimpression as to how these matters were decided and what the sequence was. The judgment was confessed on September 9th a motion was set aside, timely filed, was before my firm got involved on October 11th. Now, the matter was then heard on a Tuesday at 10 a.m. November 8th, 2016 was election day, so you can remember that one. It was heard on a Tuesday. Motions are not heard on Tuesdays. Trials are heard on Tuesdays. It was set down as a trial, and we know that because my colleagues filed a trial memorandum. They filed a trial memorandum with the court. They broke out all the arguments why they were entitled to immediate judgment.
May I ask you this? In the bankruptcy proceeding,
yes, sir.
Did Hunter Mill West LC take the position with the bankruptcy court that post-maturity compounding interest was the appropriate measure?
Justice Kelsey, it's my understanding that the exhibit that was proffered was accurate. I was not the bankruptcy counsel. That bankruptcy went on for years.
So it's don't let me put words in your mouth, but the answer yes, that was the position taken by Hunter Mill West LC?
I'm going to say I don't know. I'm not going to make an admission that I was not the counsel. I don't know. The document that's in before you was never authenticated. It was proffered. I have no reason to disbelieve the explanations that given, but I was not the counsel. I had no context for it. Quite frankly, if you read the opinion that was issued by the bankruptcy judge, it doesn't mention anything about compounding interest. All the pages of the bankruptcy record don't mention anything about compounding interest.
But at 270 of the joint appendix, the bankruptcy court makes a finding based upon the information in the schedules, and unless I'm mistaken, we're being told that Hunter Mill West LC provided the schedule which had the compounding interest formula.
I don't doubt that, and I will simply say that if it did use compounding interest, at least after maturity, it was incorrect. If you read the note is very clear that compounding interest only applies when a monthly payment becomes due.
Why doesn't res judicata apply, no matter how right you may be on the point that you're raising? Why doesn't it apply at least with respect at the time of the bankruptcy order?
Well, I speak with some trepidation because I know I'm speaking with the author of Funny Guy, and I've read it. To me, not only does the court speak through its orders, but the fact is, an issue like that where you have exhibits, there have to be given some type of context. And I think the Bernal opinion speaks to this. You actually have to have a record put before the court. To grab an exhibit and put it before a judge and say, they're bound by this, when it's not a judicial order, it's not even an authenticated document, it may frankly be a hearsay document. There's no authentication whatsoever, and then ask a court, as well as myself, to be bound by that. I'm not saying what you say is wrong.
But you want, in this analysis, if we were to go in this track, you would want to remand.
Absolutely. Okay. Because there were all sorts of statements made in that bankruptcy. In fact, if I read the bankruptcy records, one of the things they use is post-default interest of 14% instead of 24%, which they put in the confessed judgment note. I think they were incorrect in that. Again, I just looked at the note, Justice. I read the note. I read it 50 times. I can recite it to you if you'd like. You probably don't want me to. My opinion is the note controls. Now, I understand from Funny Guy that you can read outside of the court's orders and actually go a little bit more in depth. I still would argue that this issue was not even raised, and this is the point I was going to make. There was a trial on the merits. There was a hearing on the merits on November 8th.
Before you get to November 8th, has he answered your question? Are you taking the position that the bankruptcy court did not enter a judgment that included compounding interest post-maturity? Is that your position?
I'm not taking that position. Okay. I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know, Justice Powell. I mean, again, I received the bankruptcy order. I read the order. It says $1.504 million. I took that number, and I then extrapolated out using the $662 per diem that we had calculated. Again, what the bankruptcy court was thinking, I don't know. I was not the counsel at that time.
Isn't there evidence from the expert who presented the exhibit on behalf of your client that they used compounded interest?
Right, but you say Michael.
HMW is your client, correct?
Right. From the bankruptcy proceeding.
Correct.
Yes. And I understand that was in, and again, I'm taking at face value what they say, that exhibit was proffered in the bankruptcy court. I was not the bankruptcy counsel. I understand that. But I do agree that, you know, while reading the calculations, which frankly I didn't read until this appeal was taken, reading the calculations, it did look like the monthly payments compounded. Again, That to me is incorrect, because if you read the plain terms of the notes, compounding only occurs when a monthly payment comes due.
But you would agree that if that was HMW's witness and that's the information that they presented to the bankruptcy court and they used a compounding interest calculation, that your client would be bound by that in this proceeding?
Your Honor, I think that's probably one step further than I'm willing to go. I mean, to take every statement that's ever made in litigation, I mean, these parties have been in litigation for 10 years, to take every statement that's made, yes, to the extent you can impeach a witness with it, you can cross-examine with it, but to say that's res judicata, I think that's a little bit different. It's a little bit different to say a statement is res judicata as opposed to saying it's impeachment.
It's not the statement that's res judicata, it's the judgment. It's the judgment order of a court, in this case a federal bankruptcy court. That's the thing that triggers res judicata.
Well, again, Justice Kelsey, I read the order. The order doesn't say the word compounding. The judge's opinion doesn't say the word compounding. You want me to step forward and say, well, it doesn't say compounding, but it means compounding because it adopts figures which use compounding. I understand.
The question presented to you by Justice Powell is, if you get back on remand, do you see where the end game is with this? If you can't contest the fact that your client presented the information to the bankruptcy judge, endorsed it, actually vouched for it, and the bankruptcy judge used it, and in fact-finding identified it as the basis of his holding and then entered a judgment, do you have any end game beyond that?
Well, Justice Kelsey, if we do that, then I'm going to take the statements that they utilized and use that to cross-examine them, because, again, they used a different default rate than what they used in the confessed judgment. So, again, if we open up the door and bring in the whole bankruptcy proceeding, then we can have a contested case about what that means.
It seems like, in other words, you're saying that, at minimum, evidence needs to be taken to understand the parameters of whatever res judicata or collateral estoppel that might be.
Justice Goodwin, I would agree with that. I mean, as I came into the case, to me, it was a note issue. I read the note. I was not the bankruptcy counsel. The note to me was clear. Obviously, these issues came in late in the day. If we were remanded, we'll open it up and battle that out.
But that will not work if res judicata applies. You cannot open up the question if, in fact, the bankruptcy court made a judgment based upon a legal holding that compounding interest was consistent with the financial instrument post-maturity. That's what res judicata does. It shuts down litigation.
Well, Justice Kelsey, I appreciate that, but I will also say if you look at the Bernal opinion, somebody actually has to put forward the record.
Well, but that was, we're all agreeing with that. There's got to be evidence of what the court did.
And again, I don't want to get ahead of myself. I'm right here. I'm standing in front of you all in the Supreme Court. I'm not back in circuit court. I was not the bankruptcy counsel. I don't want to predict. I understand the issue you're raising. But again, let's just get back to sort of the first statement I made, which is nobody wants a summary proceeding unless they're going to win. So obviously, if it's a choice between losing or going back to Fairfax, I'll go back to Fairfax.
Sounds like maybe you'd like the non-suit issue.
Well,
to
I don't think you're allowed the non-suit as a defendant. I don't know. I might have to put that bill in.
I'm saying by that you you may very well appreciate a do-over if we decided the case on his non-suit question.
Well, we opposed the non-suit at the time because we were winning the case and we felt it had been submitted to the court. But if the court was to find that Judge Smith had skipped a step and under 8.01-433 and not put it on the trial docket and therefore they had a right to non-suit, then go ahead and let them non-suit. I mean, they certainly made that motion. It was before the court. It's a non-suit of right. Our position was it had already been submitted for decision at that point.
Let me get to the step of whether there was a trial. For those of us not familiar with the Fairfax process, I believe earlier you said, well, everyone knows that Tuesday dockets are trial dockets and not motions dockets. But Judge Smith begins that November 8th, 2016 docket by saying, I understand this is a motion to set aside confessed judgment. So that was the motion to reconsider. Your position is that date was a trial date?
Justice Powell, I use the word trial in terms of putting on witnesses and taking testimony. Motions are heard on Fridays. Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays, if a matter is set at 10 a.m., it's when evidence is being taken. So I don't know how to define the word trial other than if an evidence is going to be taken and there's going to be a hearing on the merits as opposed to a motion. That would be set for a Tuesday.
Right, but this he specifically says, this is a motion to set aside, not a trial.
That was the posture. I agree, that was the posture that it was filed by the defendant. Again, I simply mentioned that it was a Tuesday. The only reason I mentioned that, I believe there was a colloquy previously that this had been decided on a Friday motions day with the typical confusion in the court, and that was not the case. This was especially set, it was a date certain. It was a date certain.
But that was for the hearing concerning the motion to set aside and modify the confessed judgment.
That was the initial hearing, yes, sir. I'll answer any other questions. I think, again, I'm sort of reevaluating my options here, but again, we believe that the amount was properly calculated. Again, just based on the note, I understand the argument that's been made by Justice Kelsey. I would simply come back to say, and I do believe that more, if you can establish res judicata based on an exhibit that, again, was not authenticated, that's more than what I would assume res judicata means under Rule 1:6. But again, we briefed that, and if our only option is either taking a judgment against us for $2.4 million or going back to Fairfax, we'll go back to Fairfax.
All right.
Thank you very much for your time.
You have 1 minute and 5 seconds remaining.
Very quickly, then. You like a summary proceeding when you're winning, but that's exactly what the statute anticipates with a confessed judgment. You can win on a summary proceeding or on an expedited proceeding when it's for a confessed judgment for an amount that the debtor or creditor is willing to accept. Otherwise, the statutory proceeding is, once it's set aside, you proceed as if an action has been filed on the note. And that November 8th day, whether it was a Tuesday or a Friday, it doesn't matter. It was not a trial. It was a hearing to decide whether or to decide the motion to set aside. The consequences of that motion, if you set aside the judgment, it then and only then gets set back on the trial docket, and you proceed as if an action had been filed on the note. And the plaintiff must establish the liability on the note, and the defendant gets to present its defense to the note. But there was never a trial on this matter.
All right, your time has expired. The court is adjourned.
All rise.